Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is episode number 44 for November 3rd, 2011. This is Ben Stone. I'm still on the road, actually in Missouri, but so not technically on the road, but on the road in the sense that I'm not at home. And due to circumstances, I'm recording this Wednesday evening rather than Thursday morning. So if by the time that it goes live, that's not the right terminology. By the time that we put it on the internet Thursday morning, hopefully it won't be so outdated from being, 15 hours old or whatever that everyone will discount it. Anyway, I did want to cover a couple of things. First off, a blunder yesterday, which actually is today, I should say Wednesday. Wednesday, I inadvertently mislabeled the file name. No, the file name is correct. The page name is incorrectly titled on BadQuaker.com for Wednesday. But hopefully that won't cause too much of a problem. Let's see. What other old news do we have to cover? Well, let's jump right into this. Evidently, Goldline International, the gold sellers, sponsors of famous people like Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity, and the list goes on. Evidently, they're being accused of using unfair and illegal tactics in selling their products. From my understanding of the issue, they're attempting to upsell numismatic over bullion by using fear tactics involving perhaps the government might seize bullion and they might not seize numismatic coins and so forth. And people are in some way mocking Goldline International for this. Now, I realize I've never done business in any way with Goldline International, so I am completely neutral on how guilty they are, whether they're guilty or whatever. But I can speak to two issues that are pertinent to what's going on with them. One is that one of the things they're accused of is that they were heavily using telemarketers to put high levels of pressure on people to purchase numismatic coins at inflated levels that the people would never get their money back out of. And this is one thing that I have said over and over is why I have no interest in numismatic coins. Numismatic means that they have a value above and beyond their melt value. They have a value greater than the value of the metal that's in them. And I have no interest in numismatic coins for that reason. They're very volatile. It's like baseball cards or something. It's all based on what people perceive the value to be. Well, you know, that's a fiat. That's not real money. So I never, ever consider investing any kind of money whatsoever in numismatic anything. I don't care if it's coins with somebody's face on it, or if it's a baseball card or a commemorative plate or whatever. If someone gives me that, or I can pick it up at a garage sale for 25 cents and eat eggs off of it, then it has a utility and I might purchase it. But I'm not going to spend one penny for something based on its numismatic value. Telemarketers. Wow. I would like to say some really nasty things about telemarketers, except here's the problem. Telemarketers exist because people buy their product and buy into the scams. If people would just stop believing telemarketers, there would be no more telemarketers. It's that simple. The fact that people get suckered in by these people means it works. And the fact that someone is deciding to make the purchase from a telemarketer, it's not like the telemarketer is forcing them. Now, telemarketers use some pretty nasty tactics, but people should be able to take care of themselves and recognize when they're being manipulated like this. And if there's someone who's old or whatever, or they're simple-minded or whatever their problem is, that they're susceptible to this type of thing, well, unfortunately, if no one in their family or no one who cares for them can help them, then they're pretty much destined to lose their money to some scammer one way or the other. So, yes, the telemarketers are disgusting filth. And when one calls me on the phone, I'm particularly crude with them because I don't like them and I don't like what they do. On the other hand, well, let's look at it this way. Some years back, the government decided to solve the telemarketer problem. And so what they did was they set up a national do not call list. And they had, sign up put your number on this do not call list and we'll stop the telemarketers from bothering you. Well, you idiots. The telemarketers that are doing things that are illegal don't care if there's a do not call list. They're doing things that are illegal. Is that so difficult for the government? Well, I don't think the government even cares. They're just putting on a show so that they have a justification to steal more of your tax money. The do not call list is security theater exactly the same way the TSA is security theater. The do not call list does not stop illegitimate thieves, scammers, those type of people. It does not stop them from being telemarketers. The only thing the do not call list does is put restrictions on legitimate businesses and then give consumers a false sense of security. That makes their situation even more dangerous than before because they think somehow they're protected by these government ghosts that are supposed to take care of us but don't really exist. So the do not call list, like all the TSA nonsense, like all the Homeland Security nonsense, does nothing to protect you. It does nothing good. There is no good at all in the TSA, Homeland Security, the do not call list. None of those government activities serve any real positive function. They only steal from us and then offer us false security in return. That's all they do. So when a company like Goldline International decides to take advantage of the telemarketer laws and work within those laws and then sets up a scam anyway, why should we be shocked? Okay, now there's one other thing about Goldline I wanted to touch on before I pass on that topic and not think about those people anymore. There's an aspect of their scam that was absolutely true, and that is that when a government gets desperate, it seizes gold from people. It does that. The United States government did that. Let me tell a story about my grandfather. We referred to him as Poppy, but he was my mother's father. And he was a businessman. This was in eastern Kentucky. And he was not necessarily a native to the area. So for this reason, there was a lot of skepticism about him. But he came into the area, he married into locals, he ran he was a merchant, he ran a store in Ohio. So he sold his business in Ohio, he moved into rural Kentucky, in eastern Kentucky, and bought a farm and set up a general store. And so the way he would run his operation was, most of the day, his wife, my grandmother, would actually run the store, and he would either work the fields or he would take what he had produced from his farm and he would get on his wagon. He had a horse, pulled wagon, and he would take what he had grown on his farm or his produce from his farm, and then he would go from farm to farm and he would trade, and he would eventually get a wagon load of things from the different farms. And if he had to pay money to the farmers, then he would pay money. But if he had something he could trade, then he would trade. And he would attempt to get a good wagon full of stuff. And then he would make his way to the largest town that was in the area. And there was a large general store in that town. And so he would pull his wagon in there, and then he would trade with the general store. And he would either sell his goods for money at the general store, or he would trade for other goods at the general store. So in this sense, maybe someone who's raising corn but doesn't have any wheat, so they can't make flour, but they can make cornmeal. But they have no way of grinding their corn. So my grandfather would take their corn, and in the loop of the trading, he would have flour and ground cornmeal, and he would trade them back these finished goods for their raw corn. And then he would take the corn along with someone else's wheat, and he would drop it off down at the mill, and he would pay the mill operator to grind that, and in return he would take back some of what the mill operator had, or he would make a trade with him where, you get so many sacks of corn and so many sacks of wheat, and I get so much corn flour and so much wheat flour back. And as he made these trades, delivering eggs and dropping off chickens and maybe a pig or whatever, and in the process of doing all this, he would move farm goods from the local farming community into town, and he would bring city goods, textiles, bolts of cloth, not so much finished products, because these people would still finish things back on the farm themselves. So instead of buying, say, clothing, he would buy cloth. Now the exception might be something like a jacket or something like this that was a very complicated thing that was a specialty item. But typically he was taking farm goods in, and he was bringing city goods back out to the farms. And in the process, he was also bringing money into the community through the trading, because the locals didn't so much have a lot of money, but as he traded with the city people, they traded for money, so he actually was a source of real money coming back into the community. Now, he did this for years, and at some point, I know what point. It was in the early 30s, 1932, I believe, either 1932 or 1934. Anyway, all his life, he had been very, very frugal with his money. And so when he would get a little extra money at the end of the month after he'd balanced everything out, if he had a little bit of extra money, he would take some of that and he would put it in a nail keg. Now, let me explain what a nail keg is. A keg, of course, anybody who drinks beer knows what a keg is. A keg is a barrel-like object. Typically, it's reduced in size. It's not like a big barrel, like a wine barrel. A keg is generally a smaller size of a barrel. In the olden days, they were almost always made of wood. They were made of wood slots that were made in a specific fashion, so that they, with rings attached and the ends attached, it by pressure it held itself together and it held itself sealed. So a nail keg ran from about, if you can imagine, about 15 to 18 inches tall, and about, let's say about in its middle. Now, it's bigger in the middle than it is in the top, and the bottom are slightly smaller than the middle. It flares out in the middle due to the design of the keg. But in the middle, it's about as big around as like a bowling ball. And then it's about 15 to 18 inches tall. That's how big your typical nail keg was. Well, he started as a young man, and every time he got a little bit of spare money, he would put a coin in there, perhaps a $5 coin or a $20 gold piece or whatever. And most of this was gold. Very little of it was silver, because he used the silver coins on a day-to-day trading basis. So he was usually putting a $5 gold coin or a $20 gold piece into the nail keg. And he did this for years and years and years. Now, he had made a very special place for this nail keg that was behind the headboard of his bed. And my grandmother, of course, cleaned the house and took care of the house and everything like this, like they did in those days. And for years and years and years, she never knew that he had this keg of gold coins behind the headboard of their bed. Well, in the early 30s, the Roosevelt administration decided to steal from the American people because they were bankrupting the country. And so the scheme that they had come up with was to, they had devalued the price of, the dollar was based on gold. And so they had devalued the price of the dollar to the point of where the actual value of a ounce of gold was like $35, but the coin that the U.S. was circulating was only a $20 coin. So there was this value differential between the actual value of the coin and the value that the U.S. government was forcing onto the coin. So in one fell swoop, they just outlawed all gold coins in the U.S. They outlawed the possession of precious metals. Now, what that meant was you could still have your family jewelry, and if you were a jewelry maker or a jewelry dealer, you could have precious metals for the purpose of making jewelry or repairing jewelry. But and if you had certain coins that were collectibles that the government recognized as collectible coins, you could keep them. But the vast majority of all gold and silver coins became illegal to own. And what they did was they forced you to bring your gold and silver coins to a bank where you would be given Federal Reserve notes in exchange for that gold and silver. Well, when this happened, my grandfather was not too happy because he recognized exactly what it was that the government was doing. So he didn't turn in his gold. Now, there was this window of time when you were allowed grace, and if you got it in within your gold and silver in within this period of time, then it was no problem. Well, there was no way he was going to give the government back this gold that he had earned. It was his gold. Except one day, my grandmother decided to move the bed around for whatever purpose, probably cleaning behind it or whatever. And she discovered this way that he had stashed it behind the headboard. And the actual details of how he had the thing stashed and why she'd never found it previous has been lost. There are none of the family left alive who were part of that at the time. Even though my grandmother and grandfather had 12 children, they still no one is left alive that was firsthand to this story. And I got the story from my mother and my grandmother. My grandmother lived with me in our home with my mother and father until I was about 13 when she died. So I heard the story from her many times, and I heard the story from my mother many times. Anyway, so she found the gold. My grandmother found the gold. And she was furious. Not because he had hidden this from her. She understood that the reason he had hid it was because it was their retirement. It was their old age money. You see, there was no Social Security for them to fall back on. People actually planned for their old age in those days. And this is what he had kept this money for. He had planned for their old age. He knew someday he wouldn't be able to work the farm and travel and go in the wagon and do these tradings. So he was making a preparation for that. And so she understood that. She didn't have a problem with him stashing money. It was very common. What she had a problem with was that he was committing a felon and they risked losing everything because of all this gold stashed in this nail barrel. She was furious with him, and she insisted that he take it the next day, take it into the big city, and get it turned in and get it out of the house, because she did not want to have to deal with a felon and have to deal with losing everything over this nail keg full of gold coins. And at that time, the keg was full, and he had already started stashing in an alternative location. So he took the full nail keg of gold. Now let's just pause for a minute and think about that. We have an item that in its middle, it's about the size around of a bowling ball, and it's about 15 to 18 inches tall, and it's full of gold coins. Now just think about that for a minute. First off, it would be like lifting two car batteries just to pick it up, if you can imagine that in your mind, or perhaps one battery from a very large truck. It would be like that. That's about how heavy the thing would be of gold. Now, I don't know what that would, how much that would weigh. I tried to figure it out one time, and I just got really frustrated and angry because because that's our family's wealth. And gone. Now, here's what happened to it. So in his rounds that day, the next day after she found it, he put the barrel in there with all the other things, so it didn't look like anything else. It would have been not unusual at all for him to have a keg of nails that he had purchased in town and was bringing out to sell or trade at some farms, at some farmers, or even to sell part of a keg of nails. Anyway, so he had the keg in there with the rest of his goods, and as he made his rounds, he ended up getting down to where the big city was, the big town. For the time in that area, it was a good-sized town. And so he goes to the bank, and he walks in with this nail keg of gold coins. And he says, I need to turn these in. And so they open it up and look, and they tell him, well, we can't, according to law, and I can't remember the amount now, but they were only allowed to give out something like $400 or $600 in cash. I can't remember now what it was, but I'm thinking it was either $400 or $600 in cash. So what he would have to do is turn in, let's just assume it's $600. He would have to turn in $600 worth of coins and get $600 in Federal Reserve notes. And then come back tomorrow and turn in another 600, and come back tomorrow and turn in another 600. Because there were bank panics going on, and people were coming in and emptying their bank accounts. And so the bank was forbidden by law to have any exchange larger than the $600 in cash. So the bank, he was very upset about this because he couldn't go and do this over and over every single day driving around with this whole nail keg full of gold with him. You know, that's crazy. So he eventually talked to whoever the big shot was at the bank. I'll assume that was the bank president or whatever. And he's explaining his dilemma. I can't just ride around with this gold day after day after day, you know. And so the bank president says, well, it's no problem. Here's your solution. You don't have a bank account with us. Well, that's a problem right there. You need a bank account in America's modern society. So you open a bank account, you deposit all of your gold. We will give you full credit in your account for all that gold. We'll issue the maximum amount that we're allowed to give you today, $600. And then all the rest is safe in the account, you see. And whenever you want some of this money, you can just come and take some out. And whenever you want to put some more in, instead of hiding money behind your bed on your rounds, come by the bank. Drop in $2 or drop in $10 or drop in $50. And my grandfather didn't like this idea. He didn't like this at all. But he had no other choice. Because here's the problem. You see, once he walked in the door, he's not allowed to walk back out with the gold, because it now belongs to the government. And there just so happens to be a government agent in all these big banks making sure that this takes place. So it's not a matter of him even having a choice of riding around in his wagon with the gold. They're not going to let him leave with it. He can open an account and deposit it and get his $600 or whatever it was back, or he can leave without it. But either way, the gold now belongs to the government. The minute he walked into that bank and the federal agent that was in the bank understood that he had the gold, he no longer owned it. It's all over. So he had no choice. So he deposits all this gold into his account. He takes his $400 or $600 or whatever it was that they would allow him, and he leaves and he finishes his rounds. Now, the city was not normally a part of his round. He went to a big town, but he didn't go to that particular city every single day on his rounds. So it was about 2 weeks before he could get back into the big city, and he was hoping to go in. And I don't know if he was going to make a deposit or if he was going to make a withdrawal, but he went in there to the big city. And guess what? You see, in that time frame of the Depression, banks were failing right and left. And in those days, it's different than now. Nowadays, there have been a lot of bank failures in the last few years since 2008. And what happens is the FDIC comes in and they essentially, on a Friday night, they take over the bank. They do an audit of the bank. The bank is closed for Saturday. By Monday morning, it opens, but it opens under a new name. And it's under the new ownership of one of these larger banks, Chase or B of A or whoever. And they have come in and basically bought the thing out at pennies on the dollar. Now they own the bank. Sometimes the name is changed, sometimes it's not. But either way, it's just one big bank swallowing another using the fist of the FDIC. That's how modern banks die nowadays. But that's not how it was in the 30s. In the 30s, a bank would get to a point of where it was no longer solvent, and they just closed their doors. And that was it. And the money that was in there, whatever was left in there, was, if it was gold, the actual gold and silver belonged to the government, so the bank didn't own that. And whatever paper money was in there, that went to the investors in the bank, and they didn't even get the amount out that their stocks were worth, so it wasn't like they cashed in a lot when a bank died like that. And since the bank was operating on the principles of fractional reserve, the bank didn't have within its walls anywhere near the cash that its paperwork said. So it just lost it. I mean, it was all that pretend money that was on the books that wasn't in the vaults, it just disappeared. Well, that's the case with my grandfather's money. He went in with a nail keg full of gold. He walked out with $400 or $600 or whatever and a little book that told him he had money. And then in a couple weeks when he came back, that little book wasn't worth the paper it was written on because the bank didn't exist anymore and he lost his entire life savings just like that. So if you ever wonder, I wonder why Ben is so anti-government. It's because I know the government. Okay, so that's my last part on Goldline, and that's my little story about Poppy. Oh boy, there was some timely stuff in yesterday's audio article. I sent that out towards Marines, and I discussed the Navy as being the only legitimate military in the United States. And I urged in that audio article that veterans who are very, very frustrated and they see what's going on with the government and they see what's going on with the state and they see what's going on with the industry, with the big businesses and with the banks and all these things, please, please do not strike violently at the state, because when you do, you make the state stronger. I urged that in the article. And then here's this story. The FBI busts these old guys in Georgia, I believe it was. I don't have the story up on my computer, but one of them being a Navy veteran and like a 30-year veteran or something like that. And all these old guys, the FBI claims that they were planning a ricin attack and that they were trying to get silencers and explosive devices. Now, I think in two different ways on this. I think, you know, the FBI has literally faked these threats before and has ruined people's lives by setting up these sting operations with these fake threats. They're typically a 19-year-old person of some type of Islamic background so that they can demonize the Muslims even more. But on occasion, they go after the militia types to try to marginalize the right wing and try to make militias all look like nutcases. So I don't really know, you know, if the FBI did that in this case, it looks to me like they picked, these guys don't fit a lot of the real profile of people who would do stuff like this. They seem like, the little bit that I've seen found so far on them, they seem like just harmless old guys, you know? So maybe they were talking some radical nonsense. Maybe it was just, you know, internet tough guy talk, who knows? But one way or the other, the FBI has snatched them up and is going to use them as an example of why we have to have the FBI to save us from the evil right-wing homegrown terrorists. But whether real or fake, remember, folks, you cannot defeat the state. By fighting the state, using its weapons and its methods on its battleground. If I'm going to fight somebody, and he says, meet me in my backyard, and I'll have a weapon you can use when you get there, and I'll show you how we're going to fight. Why would I do that? Why would I say, no, you know what, I want to fight this guy. How am I going to fight him? Well, when he goes to the barber shop the next time, when he steps out of the barber shop, I'll crack him in the forehead with a 2x4. Hey, I'm fighting him on my terms, you see? When you want to fight somebody, forget fighting fair. Come on, this is not the third grade. If you're going to fight somebody, if it's serious enough, you know, I'm a big guy. I'm a fairly big guy. I'm not huge. I don't stand out in a crowd, but I'm bigger than most people. And I learned a long time ago that fighting on any level, violence of any kind, should be avoided almost at all cost. Almost. Because with someone like me, someone my size, I can literally break somebody's neck with a punch. So I am going to avoid violence right up almost to the bitter end because I understand how serious the consequences are, you see. Now, I will, even though I'm a Quaker, I'm a bad Quaker, therefore I'm not a complete pacifist, I will defend myself and my family and my possessions. But you have to do these things wisely. Even defense has to be done wisely. If I step around a corner and somebody's got a gun pointed at my forehead, and he totally has the drop on me, I am not going to attack him. I'm going to attempt in every way to please him, give him the money that he wants, whatever. If he's distracted for a moment and I see the opportunity, I might take action. But I might just as easily allow him to rob me, then find out who he is, and then follow him, and then deal with the problem. But I'll deal with it on my terms. And that's the way. That's wisdom when you're dealing with any kind of a confrontation on any level. If you're going to go in and buy a new car, if you go into a car dealership and the car salesman realizes that he totally has you on his ground, on his terms, and to all of his advantages, you're desperate, you have money, and you don't know anything about the product. Cha-ching. See, but if you go into the car dealership knowing what you're looking for, knowing the product, knowing the price, and knowing what you'll pay for it, then you've got a whole different set of circumstances. But I still try to avoid car dealers because it's their territory. Much better if I'm going to buy a vehicle of some kind. Much better for me to do it on an equal level with someone who doesn't have all the advantages. And how much more so when you're dealing with the government? Why? Would you want to fight the government using the government's weapons and the government's battlefield and the government's methods? No. Like I said in the article yesterday, the government's methods are theft, lies, and aggression. So we combat those with peaceful, voluntary trade, commerce. That's how we combat theft. Private, peaceful, voluntary commerce is the opposite of taxation and the threat of taxation and the stealing that the government does by debasing the value of money and all the things that the government does to steal from us. Private commerce, private, meaning the government doesn't know about it. Private commerce combats the theft of the government. Lies. The government lies. Do you know how you know the government is lying? Because the mainstream media is talking to you, or a politician is talking to you, or a corporation is trying to sell you something and they're talking to you, or a corporation is having a commercial that tells you how green they are and how they're helping the environment, or how they're helping the economy. That's how you know the government, that's how you know the state is lying to you. If the media or the government or corporations are telling you something, they're lying. See how easy that is? And so how do we combat their lies? You can only combat lies with truth. Seek truth in all things. And the more you can grasp and the more you can promote the truth, the more lies fade away. And the last thing, the government, all government actions and the state as a whole, all government actions are based on aggression. Well, how do you face aggression? not defense, remember, aggression. The zero aggression principle is the opposite of aggression. So again, if we have peaceful, private interactions with other people, and we respect each other's property rights. You see, you can't have aggression if you're respecting property rights, and you can't have property rights if you're not utilizing aggression. Aggression and property rights are exact opposite of each other, just like lies and truth are exact opposite of each other. So the way that we combat the aggression of the state and the aggression of governments and the aggression of corporations, and the way that we combat this aggression is through an understanding and promotion of true natural property rights. That's how we do this. We don't buy ricin and try to make bombs and get silencers and talk about executing that. No, shut up. You're hurting. You're making the state stronger when you do that. All you right-wing idiots out there, stop it. You're doing the exact opposite of helping. Okay. Next. Okay, let's jump back to, I believe it was Friday's podcast about preparation, about being prepared, about doing things to get prepared in your life. And my point being that not only will the state fail, I've said this over and over and over, the state is unstable economically, morally, in every way. The state is unstable and the state will fall. But the state is not the American government. The United States government is a state, and yes, it is an arm of the overall state, but the United States government can rise and fall, and the state will continue. And yes, the U.S. government will fall at some point. We're setting ourselves up for a major fall in the U.S. government. And so that's going to happen. But it's smart to prepare for that. But it's also smart to prepare for local governmental failures. Local governmental failures as in road construction that never ends. So you have to figure out ways in your life to think up alternative routes so that you're not stuck in traffic for 6 hours when you really need to be somewhere. That's the local failure of government. Another local failure of government is what we saw in the last few days. And that is a freak storm comes through and wipes out electricity for millions of people. And they're going to be down maybe weeks with no electricity. And to add insult to injury, the governor of Connecticut comes out in the news and complains that the Department of Energy wasn't sending him enough people from outside of his state to help him. So here's the governor of Connecticut complaining that the federal government is not taking enough action. And yet at the same time, the Weather Channel's telling us, oh, but the government does a good job in these things. You see, they're actually admitting what I was saying on Friday, that when you think that utility companies are private companies, they're not. The product that they sell, the product they produce, the product they distribute, and the product that they sell is all entirely managed by the government. All the regulations in place, all the monopoly laws that manage all of the whole process of getting all of the utilities to your house, it's all fascism. It's all a fascist process. It's all socialism. It is the government. So we know fascism fails. We know socialism always fails. And so every single one of those utilities, you should always assume it's going to fail you. If you have a house that can only be heated through natural gas, then you should expect the natural gas to fail at some point in time. If you have a house that's heated with natural gas, but it requires a blower of some kind for the furnace to work, then you need backups for both. Individually, in case you lose one and have the other. But you need backups for both, because the government will fail you. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Is it going to happen today? Is it going to happen next winter? Is it going to happen in the middle of the summer? Is it going to happen in February and you're shut down for 2 weeks with no power? Now, what would happen if this same power outage had hit the East Coast, those same communities in Connecticut and New Hampshire and New Jersey, if the same power outage had hit in the heart of February, what if that kind of a power outage came through Michigan and Ohio and Indiana in February when we're hitting 0 degrees? How many people would just die in their homes? Because you're depending on the government. And you may not think it's the government when you're thinking about these utilities, but they're public utilities. Public utilities. That means they're not private utilities. They are public utilities. All of these companies who work hand in hand with the government to provide you your electricity, your natural gas, even to a lesser extent, but even bottle gas. The nice thing about having bottle gas or LP gas or whatever you want to call it is that you, on your own, can have an extra supply. You can get an extra tank, or you can get a larger tank, and you can make sure that you have extra that will last you an extra 3 months or 6 months or a year or whatever. So that's an advantage there. But still, all these utilities, in the long run, it's a tentacle of the government. And if you're depending on the government to keep you alive, wow, come on. Now, what about grocery stores? Grocery stores are in the same situation. They have this just-in-time inventory where they order stuff and it's delivered within a day or two of when they expect to be sold out of it. So they don't have a reserve of a lot of things in a grocery store because they're constantly expecting another delivery every day, more and more deliveries to bring the stuff in that they're selling. So they no longer have a large store of goods on hand. So you have some emergency that happens, and bang, in a matter of a few hours, they have nothing else on their shelves, bare shelves, because the delivery didn't come, or because the road's cut off and they're going to be 2 days behind, or whatever. That's all it takes. So if you're depending on a grocery store to keep you alive, and you're depending on the electric company to keep you alive, and you're depending on the road system to keep you alive, and you're depending on unionized truck drivers delivering that stuff to the grocery store or delivering the gas to the gas station to keep you alive, then you're depending on the government to keep you alive. You're depending on the state, on tentacles of the state. That's who you're depending on for your life. Okay. Enough on preparation. Let's see, I've kind of rambled on today, but I did want to touch at least one more thing. Oh no, you know I got to do two things. I'll do one really quick. I saw this story, and it's in the UK, the government is setting up fake cell towers to spy on cell phone users. They can actually just listen to the cell phones through their cell towers. And also they have the capability to shut off your cell phone. You're there talking on your cell phone, and they decide to shut it down. They can send a signal to your phone that shuts down your cell phone. Now, wouldn't that be handy if you were a tyrannical government and the vast majority of all photography and, you know, movies and pictures and everything were taken through cell phone, and there was a protest that was starting to get a lot of people taking pictures of something that you didn't want, that the government doesn't want seen, so you could just shut down all the cell phones that are trying to send the pictures or that are trying to take the pictures of a particular event, or shut down all the cell phones within a particular geographic area. Wouldn't that be handy if you were a really nasty tyrant? That's just a thought, but anyway. I'll put a link to that story on the page. I linked to that in Facebook because I thought it was a really interesting story. And the last thing I'm going to wrap up with today is I saw a headline that said that, well, I read the story. I saw the headline and then I read the story. Well, odd how that happens. Anyway, Congress, the lobbyists, In the past, let's do it this way. In the past, the lobbyists would give Congress, members of Congress, or staff of members of Congress, they would give these, essentially they were vacations. What they were, oh, this is a fact-finding, or this is a we're inviting you for a lecture, or, you know, and what it really is you go on this cruise ship, and you get up and give a 5-minute speech or whatever, so then all your expenses are free on the cruise ship. Thank you very much, pharmaceutical company. Or, you know, you're on a fact-finding mission to the Middle East or whatever, and what you end up doing is taking your entire family and all your staff and their family and everything else, and you know, a single trip is like $500,000, and you end up touring, you know, half a dozen major cities, several of which are gambling meccas, and somehow you seem to have an unlimited spending allowance during that time. Thank you very much, you know, major defense contractor or whoever. See, so in 2007, Congress self-regulated. They wrote a rule for themselves saying they could no longer do that, except the numbers for 2011 so far show that this year it's a 75% increase from last year of those kinds of things. In other words, not only do they ignore the law, but they are increasing by 75% over the amount that they ignored the law last year. They can't even obey their own laws. And yet they write laws to tell us how much water can go through our shower, how much water goes through your toilet when you flush it, whether or not you can buy this kind of light bulb or whether you can buy that kind of light bulb, if you can buy this kind of table saw or if you have to buy this table saw for 30% higher in price. They can write laws on that force us to behave the way they want us to behave, but they won't even follow their own rules. They won't even obey their own stuff, which goes further to my point that I made yesterday in the article, that the government that is based in Washington, D.C. is a rogue government operating outside of the law. It has no true legal jurisdiction and is an entirely an illegitimate body. However, they have the guns. Don't forget what I said about fighting a person according to your strengths, not according to their strengths. Folks, thanks for listening to today's podcast. Be sure and check us out at badquaker.com if you have any questions or anything. You know, I forgot to give the information. When I had Kirk on, if you have any questions or anything for Kirk, and if you can't figure out how to contact him on his websites and through the links that we gave, just drop me a note at ben@badquaker.com, and I'll pass that on to Kirk. He's a great guy. I've known him for several years now, and he's a really good person. Anyway, thanks for listening. Be sure and check back with us again. I'm going to try to, even though we're on the road, so to speak, I'm going to try to give you an article every day. Friday, I don't know. I don't know if I'll be able to get an article out on Friday or not. We're going to have a lot of stuff going on, but I'll try. Folks, thanks a lot.